Welcome to Public International Law in a Nutshell, the CIS podcast series. My name is Niklas Gantenberg and with me today is...
Lena Faber. Hi, Niklas.
Hey, Lena. How are you doing today?
Really good. And you?
I'm doing great. What are we going to learn about today?
Well, in today's episode, we will present to you a very short history of public international law. It's going to be an intense and demanding ride because we'll summarize hundreds of years of legal history in just 25 minutes. So buckle up and enjoy our podcast.
Throughout the episode, the following questions shall be answered. What and who were the driving forces in the development of international law?
We therefore not only want to retell the commonly taught history of international law, but rather reflect critically on the circumstances through which it spread over the world. Thereby, questions of Eurocentrism, imperialism, and colonialism will arise.
Inspired by renowned critical scholar Anthony Angi, Lena and I will break down the development of international law into three different phases: naturalism, positivism, and pragmatism. The aim of our podcast is twofold. Firstly, we hope to give you a concise overview on how the prevailing understanding of international law has been made and found. However, we also hope to raise the question to which extent its history can make the claim of representing a global narrative.
As our source of expertise, we interviewed Professor Dr. Anne Peters, director of the Max Planck Institute for Comparative Public Law and International Law in Heidelberg.
Ever since organized human societies have existed, there were rules to regulate their relations among each other. However, phase one of our journey today, naturalism, will start in medieval Europe. In Europe, the legal understanding during the Middle Ages was based on jus divinum, lex naturalis, and jus positivum. The jus divinum was the law from God and was understood supreme, standing above any other forms of law. Under the jus divinum stood the lex naturalis, the natural law, which was the reflection of divine law in humans in the form of rationality and morals. Finally, the lowest form of law was the jus positivum, the positive law, which was disseminated by a human legislator and based on consent. A European nascent understanding of international law at that time was the jus gentium, the law of nations, from the Holy Roman Empire. Since the empire kept expanding over time, there was an increasing need to govern the relations between foreigners.
Okay, so the beginnings of international law in Europe can be traced back to the Holy Roman Empire, with the Christian religion playing an important role in its understanding. At that time, England, France, and Spain were rising as nation-states, and therefore the need to regulate the relations between sovereign entities emerged. Important thinkers such as Machiavelli, Baudin, and Aquinas disagreed on the way this sovereignty could and should be limited, and which role religion should play.
However, as commonly found in Western literature, one of the most important thinkers of this period was the Dutch lawyer Hugo Grotius. In his work on the Law of War and Peace from 1625, he combined the conception of natural law and of the law of nations, trying to merge them into one single framework. By doing this, he sought to create a combination of morality and effective restraints on states. Another important contribution was his effort to detach the law of nature from theology, meaning that natural law would be valid even if there were no God. Natural law would rather be derived from the principle of reason.
Well, he surely sounds like an important man.
Indeed, Western historiography of international law often celebrates him as the father of international law. But Lena, his theoretical contribution surely cannot be the only source in the emergence of modern international law.
Yeah, you're right, Niklas. The key word here is the Peace of Westphalia of 1648, an event which is often referred to as the origin of modern international law. Some scholars argue that it marked the emergence of the concept of the sovereign European state as we know it today. This is because the peace led to the end of the secular power of the Pope over the internal affairs of other states, as Catholic and Protestant states were considered sovereign and could freely choose their religion. Therefore, in one state, there existed only one authority, like a king or prince, to govern the internal relations.
Ah, so the existence of sovereign equal states in Europe created the need for rules to govern the relations between them?
Yeah, exactly. This is precisely why scholars refer to it as the origin of modern international law, the legal order regulating the relations between states.
Origin of modern international law. That is a big claim. I think it is important to stress that this view is increasingly contested in literature. For example, the scholar Gleider Hernandez writes that it is already Eurocentric to hold on to the importance of the Peace of Westphalia. Onuma Yasuaki continues that European international law was still far from being truly universal at that time. The Peace of Westphalia is the first example in our podcast highlighting that most historiographies of international law emphasize European thoughts and events to represent the origins of modern international law.
And another aspect which should not be forgotten is that not every state on the globe was considered sovereign and equal. Only the established Christian European nation states of the time. As a result, the overseas expansion of the Europeans in the 16th and 17th century was justified by the assumption that non-European people were not capable of forming an own lawful government or to hold property, and that there was a legal vacuum, terra nullius, which therefore could be occupied.
Good that you mention it. Grotius even refers to the more civilized nations and explains that, quote, some nations are so strange that no fair judgment of human nature can be formed from them, for it would be erroneous, quote end.
Wow, that is a racist statement. I wonder what the standards were to be considered a so-called civilized nation, and if after Grotius this notion continued to play a role in the understanding of international law.
Well, the difference between civilized and uncivilized nations has indeed played a big role in international law throughout its history. And the family of nations, as it was called at that time, was limited to European states. And of course, the European nations considered themselves to be superior, but there was also, one could say, a mutual barbarization going on. For example, in the relations with China, and China calls itself the Middle Kingdom, from the Chinese perspective, it was clear that the Chinese were the civilized and the others were the barbarians. So there was a mutual barbarization, one could say. Initially, civilized meant Christian. So it was a Christian family of nations, and therefore it was an important historical step when in 1856, in a peace treaty, the Ottoman Empire became also part of the system of the balance of powers, because that was the first non-Christian member of this community. But still, the ranking and hierarchies persisted. For example, there is a famous writing by the Scottish international lawyer James Lorimer. In his book on the Law of Nations, he established a classification of states which ranged from the fully civilized to the imbecile nations.
Grotius, the Renaissance, and the Peace of Westphalia contributed to a rise of a more positivist conception of international law, which leads us to enter phase two, the rise of positivism. In the late 17th and 18th century, the conception of what were considered legal sources kept developing.
The Grotians argued that there was a union between natural law and the law of nations. The naturalists, however, saw international law as only consisting of natural law alone. An important contribution to the discussion was the book The Law of Nations or the Principles of Natural Law of 1758 by Emmerich de Vattel. He argued that only positive law was relevant.
So, Lena, did this positivist development stop here, or can we say that Vattel's legacy continued into the 19th century?
It definitely did. The turn to positivism led to a far-reaching development in legal reasoning. The law of nature, as a legal source rooted in Christian universalism, was abandoned. Legal reasoning was increasingly based on Enlightenment ideas, with a commitment to scientific rationality. Another important development considered the sovereign state as the exclusive subject of international law.
Lena, I feel like you should explain that to our listeners.
Sure. So we're at a point in time when the law of nations is based on positive law. This meant that only laws which had been consented to by states were valid rules governing their conduct. It was not about consent between individual human beings, but about consent between sovereign states. This is why states solely were the subject of international law.
Ah, I see. Wasn't the Congress of Vienna of 1815 a milestone in this regard? Because there the European states wanted to create, by treaty, a new and permanent system of European public law. And the aim was to build enduring peace after the war-ridden Napoleonic period. So the Congress marked a turning point in European international relations because some great powers were asserted special responsibilities, for example, to intervene when peace was threatened. And this power based itself on a claimed superiority of these states.
So, wait a minute. Did this development only affect Europe? I'm a bit confused because I thought we were talking about the history of international law here.
Well, yes and no. On the one hand, only so-called civilized European states were part of this exclusive community. However, through colonial expansion, their understanding of international law spread over the globe. Malcolm Shaw describes this as a paradox. Whilst international law became geographically internationalized through this expansion of the European empires, it became less universalist and more a reflection of European values.
Niklas, in this regard, I would say it is important to mention the Berlin Conference of 1884 and 85.
Very true. Would you like to explain why?
Well, the conference saw the great European powers of the period come together to decide on how Africa was to be divided among them. It becomes apparent that with its doctrines validating conquest, unequal treaties, and terra nullius, European international law was authorizing and legitimizing colonialism. By the end of the 19th century, European colonial expansion had therefore ensured that European international law had been established globally as the one single system applying to all societies.
Okay, we have now arrived in phase 3, pragmatism. The 20th century saw the consolidation of the international law system, which is still in place today. While its dominant intellectual approach remained rooted in positivism, this phase can be characterized by the emergence of an increased need for legal pragmatism. After the First World War, the League of Nations was founded in 1920. The organization's main goals aimed at the prevention of wars through collective security and the settling of international disputes through negotiation and arbitration. It was the first interstate organization that aspired to universal membership.
Okay, that sounds good. But not every state was deemed equal under the covenant of the League of Nations. For example, the former colonies of the defeated powers, Germany and the Ottoman Empire, were regarded to lack institutional capacity or commitment to establish independency and therefore required, in the eyes of the colonial powers, the support of the League. This is why the League established the so-called mandate system.
In the League of Nations Covenant from 1922, there was the provision on mandate territories, and the mandate of the more advanced nations over the less advanced was called a sacred trust of civilization. And there were three kinds of mandates called A, B, and C mandates. For example, the states coming out of the former Ottoman Empire, there were one category, Central African states, were another category, and Southwest African Pacific yet another category. When decolonization came about in the 1950s and 60s, which was fully completed only in the 90s, there were lots of new states emerged, and theoretically, formally, they enjoy sovereign equality like all other states. However, there are still categories in law and political life. For example, we make the distinction between developed and developing countries. However, this term has now more been substituted by Global South. Critical legal scholars argue that there still is, despite formal decolonization, an informal dependency due to economic and political dependency, and that this is kind of an informal empire, and that international law still has to be decolonized.
So we can see that although the League of Nations for the first time aspired to have universal character and include all nations, it measured the ability of nations to be independent according to the ideal of a European nation state. So, in gaining political independence, post-colonial nation-states were essentially forced to travel the development path mapped out for them by Western states.
That is true, but as much as this can and should be criticized, the newly sovereign third world states, for the first time in history, had been given a voice and an entry into international law. Other important developments were the establishment of the Permanent Court of Justice in 1921 and the first multilateral human rights treaties.
Well, but ultimately, despite these minor successes, the League failed to prevent the Second World War, right?
Exactly. And in response to this, the charter of a new organization, the United Nations, was signed in San Francisco in 1945. Similar to its predecessor, the United Nations aimed above all to preserve international peace and security. However, its purposes went further. On the one hand, the Charter called for increased cooperation on economic, social, cultural, and humanitarian questions and a respect for human rights without discrimination. On the other hand, the sovereign equality of states became a significant feature of the new international order.
We're talking about sovereign equality now, but what happened to the colonies?
Good that you asked, Niklas. The task of decolonization remained one of the central concerns and challenging tasks for the UN. With the continuing emergence of sovereign states in Africa and Asia, specifically during the 1960s, international law continued to become increasingly universal. Rather than being excluded, these states could now participate in the system, at least formally, as sovereigns and equals. In light of this, the recognition of human rights also advanced greatly and emerged as a central part of the United Nations period, beginning with the adoption of the 1948 Universal Declaration of Human Rights.
Another related, very important development is the so-called humanization of international law. The fact that now all areas of international law, ranging from law of armed conflict to trade and investment law, are being imbued by human rights, so that all approaches must be human rights-based. That is it's very weak still in trade law and investment law. There's a lot of critique that human rights are pushed to the margin and so on, but the overall trend is pretty clear. And I think that is also an important, although not abrupt, but long-term paradigm-shifting trend, which may, of course, also be reversed. It's not guaranteed that it will go on forever.
Although human rights are often celebrated, they can also be subject to criticism. Post-colonial approaches to international law state that it is no longer possible to deny, once again, the European origin of the human rights regime. So, we were wondering and asking our expert Professor Peters how likely she views the inclusion of new perspectives into the understanding of international law and its principles, such as human rights.
I can't answer the question. Because it's quite speculative. I don't know. As I said, we should not overestimate the power of scholarship, because so far the law, specifically international law, has mostly responded or reacted to other factors, economic and political factors. So in a way, international law depends on conditions which it cannot guarantee itself. On the other hand, I still believe ideas and ideals shape the behavior of humans, and good ideas can travel throughout the world and will not halt before borders, and therefore they can, on the long run, make a difference.
Our journey has now arrived in the present day. Niklas, would you like to explain to our listeners one example of how the heritage of international law's history can still be found today?
Yes, of course. One obvious heritage of its history can be found in Article 38, 1c of the Statute of the International Court of Justice, also referred to as the World Court. There it says, quote, "The court, whose function is to decide in accordance with international law, Such disputes as are submitted to it shall apply the general principles of law recognized by civilized nations. Quote end. In the International Law Commission, it is currently being discussed whether this formulation should be replaced or if that would be merely a cosmetic adjustment and nothing of real importance. We asked Professor Peters for her opinion.
So this term has been inherited from the statute of the Permanent Court of International Justice, which was the court in the League of Nations. So this text is from 1923 or so. It's an old language which has not been changed after the Second World War. This provision refers to the general principles, and it says that general principles of law can be derived from those principles that are recognized by the civilized nations, but the interpretation nowadays is clear that the term civilized has no meaning, that the general principles can be identified by looking at the practice of all states. There is no controversy about that. And this is also imperative in the light of Article 2.1, which prescribes the sovereign equality of states. There are more modern texts which basically say the same thing. For example, the statute of the International Criminal Court, which dates from 1998, also contains a provision on the applicable law and says which law the court must apply. That's in Article 21. And here, more modern language is used. It says that general principles of law derived from national laws of legal systems of the world. So the word civilized was dropped. I think that a formal amendment of the UN Charter or of the statute of the International Court of Justice would be exceedingly difficult. Replacing the word would be merely symbolic legislation, but I think it is unlikely because that could also be interpreted in a way giving too much significance to the term. So I don't think it would make a big difference, to be honest.
We've hereby come to the end of our historical journey. Reminding ourselves of the question we posed in the beginning, Lena, after all, what and who were the driving forces in the development of international law?
Well, we have seen that international law as we know it today is heavily impacted by European conceptions. Our very short history of international law, which mostly followed the conventional Western historiography, cannot make the claim to be complete. As Japanese scholar Onuma Yasuaki describes it, quote, "History is composed of countless facts. The very act of selecting historical facts and describing a history based on these selected facts already assumes a certain perspective." Quote end.
We purposefully and consciously chose to present the European perspective because, despite the increasing emergence of alternative historiographies of public international law, the European conventional storytelling still prevails. So, in order to further the critical interaction with the existent understanding of public international law, we deem it necessary to first lay a basis of knowledge, which then, in a second step, should be criticized, expanded, and refined to include a multitude of perspectives.
Especially scholars which focus on third world approaches to international law, short TWAIL, argue that the commonly told history ignores the contributions other areas of the world have made to the formation of certain legal doctrines and rules as we know them today. This is why our podcast episode, while it aims at criticizing the Eurocentric approach to the history of international law, still cannot claim to satisfy a universalist approach to the field.
As Professor Peters writes, quote, "More pluralism within the international legal discourse is needed, because international law aspires to be universal, but carries a historical baggage of Eurocentrism. This legacy cannot simply be denied or erased, but can be acknowledged and problematized." Quote end.
This was today's episode of Public International Law in a Nutshell, the CIS podcast series. Thank you for listening. We hope to have you with us again next time. Stay safe.